Welcome to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for listening this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, coronavirus cases are on the rise again in Florida, mainly among two groups of people, the young and the unvaccinated. Now, the number of new cases statewide is nearly double that of the previous week. And at the same time, the rate of vaccinations that are being given out, well, they also went down last week around the state. That is not good news. At a time when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's projected data shows that this more contagious Delta variant of the virus now accounts for more than half of all COVID cases. We're beginning the hour here on the Florida Roundup with a closer look at this worrying spike in COVID around the state and also the reluctance of too many out there to get the vaccine. Let us know your thoughts, Florida. Have you been vaccinated? Maybe you're hesitating. Do you know someone who's gotten sick with COVID? Are you a doctor yourself and have some concerns about this? Just call us up wherever you are in the state. 305-995-1800 and tweet us at Florida Roundup. Our first guest is Dr. Ali Mokhdad. He's Chief Strategy Officer with Population Health at the University of Washington, studying coronavirus around the country. Dr. Mokhdad, so good to have you back on the show. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So the data shows that virtually everyone coming into hospitals this week in Florida is unvaccinated, 99% just about. Now, this is unfortunately interacting with this contagious Delta variant of the virus. You're tracking these two data points around the country. So what are your concerns for Florida?
So this is becoming a epidemic of unvaccinated people, quite honestly. And we are tracking vaccine hesitancy in every state at the county level and at the zip code level. And there are areas in Florida that vaccination rates are very low. And unfortunately, we'll see a rise in cases among these places and hospitalization and mortality. Of course, most of the people who are not vaccinated are the young adults. So that's why we're seeing a rise in cases among young adults and mortality, unfortunately, as well.
That's right. And so younger people and the unvaccinated are most at risk now for coming down with the disease, having to be hospitalized. The pandemic is still with us. What's your message to Florida residents out there who've started to drop their guard? Maybe they're not wearing masks anymore. They feel the pandemic is in the rearview mirror. The data is just showing that's not true.
No, the pandemic is not over. That's the message that we all in the United States and in Florida, we should acknowledge that this pandemic is still with us. The virus has still room to mutate and we will have more variants unless we control the spread of the virus and the infections. And the only way to do it right now is to go and get the vaccine. We have effective vaccines in the United States and very safe vaccine and plenty of it. Every one of us should go and get the vaccine. And for those of us in Florida who got the vaccine, it's on us to call our friends, people who we know did not get the vaccine yet, and ask them, please convince them, telling them, you know, your own experience, these vaccines are safe. They will save your lives. Take your vaccine in order to save your life, to be around your loved ones, and make sure we can help our economy flourish at this time. We don't want any more shutdowns in the U.S.
The vaccine protects you from hospitalization and death from a serious case of COVID. The data on that is clear, Dr. Mokhdad. So how then to talk to vaccine hesitant people? A lot of people have fallen prey to misinformation about COVID vaccines, everything from false claims that they can affect fertility to worries that they can alter someone's DNA. People even think falsely that the vaccines make you magnetic. There's so much junk out there that people are hearing, and it's causing them not to trust the vaccine. Now, at the same time, other people who are vaccine hesitant will point out that in the past, big drug companies have sometimes acted unethically. That they've been gaslit about medical information in the past, particularly people of color feel that way. So how do you then talk to people about this in a way that can reassure them that the vaccine is safe and effective?
No, that's true. I mean, we've had bad history when it comes to certain practices in the United States, especially against minorities. But let's be realistic here. We have a pandemic at hand right now. We know, quite honestly, that the vaccine will prevent you from a trip to the hospital and to the morgue. I mean, that's very important to remember, everybody. That's one. The second point, even when it comes to people who are hesitant right now, we have over 335 million doses of the vaccine provided in the United States. We've already provided so many doses in the United States. We have over 3.4 billion doses provided globally. And we haven't seen any side effects that the anti-vax people are putting out in social media. And that's the problem, quite honestly. Social media, people putting out rumors, unfounded rumors out there, and then being sent by other people as well. So my message for people out there is, please, when you get a message, even from one of your friends, make sure that you know what the source of this message and who's behind it and why they are behind it. Vaccines save lives. That's why we are here, all of us. We don't have polio anymore in the United States. I worked at CDC for 20 years. If you walk inside the CDC, there is a museum. You could see an iron lung. And we know the history in the United States, how much we suffered from polio. We don't talk about polio anymore in the United States because of vaccines. And the last point I want to make very quickly here, there is a lot at stake with COVID-19 vaccines. So the companies, it's the reverse here. Companies are more scared to make a mistake with COVID-19 vaccine because everybody is watching COVID-19 vaccines. So any company that produces vaccines out there is so careful about the quality and what they are doing when it comes to COVID-19 vaccine. So this vaccine is safer than any other vaccine out there simply because it will backfire on routine immunization. And we have a lot at stake here and we want to make sure this is a safe vaccine.
We're talking about the spike in COVID cases in Florida right now here on the Florida Roundup. It's young people and unvaccinated people who are coming into hospitals this week. 305-995-1800. Michael in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting, but I'm 25. I actually had COVID-19 in December of last year, and I haven't been vaccinated. I haven't been sick again. I was actually pretty wary of getting the vaccine for a plethora of reasons, not because I think it's going to make me magnetic or anything else like that, but mainly because I'm just wary of putting anything in my body, especially something that wasn't, you know, FDA approved at the time. But I guess, you know, what he said about polio hit home. I had heard that before, and I don't think people are thinking about that. I'm kind of on the fence. I'm not against the vaccine, but I haven't been sick again. I already had COVID-19, so I'm not necessarily, like, forced to go get it because I'm scared. So what would you recommend?
Sure.
I know you're going to recommend.
Michael,
I know you'll recommend vaccination, but
yeah. And you know what, Michael, I so appreciate you calling, particularly since you're a young man and it's younger people, Dr. Mokhtar, who are now the ones coming into hospitals needing oxygen. So what's your message to Michael?
Michael, listen, we know from these vaccines that they provide more immunity than previous infections. And if you look at previous infections from COVID-19, they haven't protected many people from the Delta variant. So look at what happened, for example, in India. In New Delhi, we had about 60, 70% of the people infected. And when the outbreak came from the Delta variants that we are dealing with right now in Florida, they had a surge of cases and mortality. So you need to take the vaccine. But my message to you, Michael, I have one daughter, only one daughter. She is the joy of my life. She got the vaccine, she's 21. I took the vaccine, my wife, my mom. So people that I love and I care about took the vaccine, and that has been my recommendation. I'm treating you like my daughter here. Go and get the vaccine.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. And, you know, I know of someone who's a young adult in Jacksonville where I work, doctor, who is in the hospital. And so, you know, what I the message from all of the public health experts and doctors to Floridians younger than 50 in particular is please get vaccinated. People 50 and older, senior citizens, for the most part, almost everyone in that age group has gone out and gotten vaccinated. It's younger people who are now making up more of the patients in hospitals in Florida as this Delta variant surges. And to be clear, folks, if you're going to the hospital, you can't breathe, okay? You need oxygen. That's who's going into hospitals. So just imagine being so sick that you can't catch a breath and you have to go to be hooked up to a machine to literally be able to breathe. That is what is happening. So, Dr. Mokhtad, stick with us because we want to touch on some more issues around the pandemic. As the virus is surging this week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's reelection campaign came under some criticism. They're selling merchandise branded with the catchphrase, "Don't Fauci my Florida." Now, the phrase is a dig at Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease specialist. Also this week, Norwegian Cruise Line filed a lawsuit against Florida's Surgeon General, hoping to put an end to the new state law preventing businesses from requiring customers to show proof of COVID-19 vaccination. A.G. Gankarski is a reporter for Florida Politics, and he joins us now via Zoom to talk about the politics of all this. A.G., are you there? Okay, we're going to have to get him to unmute his Zoom. But as we talk about this, Dr. Ali Mokhtad, you're not a political guy. Oh, there you are, A.G. A.G., what's your take on the criticism that Governor DeSantis is getting this week for this anti-Fauci merchandise?
He's playing to the base again. He had his couple of weeks of Surfside where he worked with the White House very closely, said nothing but good things about the Biden administration coming through. But in the end, it's retail politics, and retail politics involves retail. And what's better retail for, you know, the hard right in this country than anti-Fauci merchandise, the beer koozies, the Don't Fauci My Florida you mentioned, but also the, you know, how the heck am I supposed to drink a beer through a mask beer koozie? That's apparently the top seller. So DeSantis knows exactly what he's doing. He's playing fast and loose with it. And but it's driving the fundraising, which kind of slowed down in the last couple of months because, you know, real life interfered with politics. He's got to get back to that because Republicans have short memories.
Lots of tweets about the governor's actions here are just a couple. Mike says, I think this makes it clear that not only has DeSantis ignored, mocked, and politicized health experts at the expense of public health, but he's now profiting and campaigning off of it. It's now a clear matter of ethical violations and conflict of interest that violates Florida's residents' safety. One more tweet. Using a global pandemic to raise campaign funds while hospitals in Florida are filling with patients is disgusting. So, A.G. Gankarski, as you say, these actions by the governor play to his hardcore base of supporters, but they're angering a lot of other Florida residents, too, as we see these cases of COVID spiking once again around the state.
Yeah, and I think we're getting toward a herd immunity one way or the other thing. I mean, vaccinations have really plateaued in recent months. They're universally available, but people aren't getting them despite being, you know, prodded and poked and told they really need to do this. And we're in what, the fourth wave of this now, Delta?
Yeah.
The evidence is all here and people aren't getting the shots. And those people are, you know, they're also independents, from what I'm seeing. It's not just Republicans per se, but it's also independents, and that tracks with DeSantis polling. He does well with independents. They like his bravado. They like his style. You know, they like the fact that he's a governor that you're willing to have a beer with. And, you know, he went around the state and said, you got vaccines here, you got vaccines there. You know, he was accused of vaccine favoritism. So we definitely had that ramp up, but there seemed to be a point where the administration just kind of washed their hands of it. Get your COVID data weekly now, so even as this virus is exponentially surging and, you know, crippling hospitals and ERs and ICUs and every other measure of capacity, You get weekly stats, so you can't really track this stuff in the way that you could previously with even the flawed statistics the state was providing. So it's interesting, and obviously this is cresting just as hurricane season gets underway. So we're going to see some hard decisions made in shelters in the coming months, too.
Yeah, that's also a concern for sure. Stephen in Wellington, Florida is on the phone. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Good, thank you for taking my call. I am not for the first time absolutely disgusted by our governor and our state government who have no concern whatsoever for the health of Floridians, only for the maintaining power. That is their one and only goal. They have been lying to us from the beginning. The count death rate and the infection rate at the very beginning was completely fabricated by the governor, and now he should resign. He won't. He should, until the people of Florida finally say enough is enough. We want a government that cares about our health. Thank you.
Stephen, you know, thanks. There is an election next year. Governor DeSantis will face a Democratic opponent, either Nikki Fried or Charlie Crist. AG, as the governor takes criticism over the anti-Fauci merchandise at the same time, Norwegian Cruise Line is taking aim at the administration. They've asked a federal court to throw out the state's ban on vaccine passports. They say the ban that the governor pushed hurts its ability to prevent the spread of the virus on board ships. So given the cruise industry's importance to Florida, is the governor taking this too far?
No, this is the kind of states' rights thing that DeSantis has been pushing since Biden got elected, really. And this is another conflict between what the state wants to do and what the feds want to do. And this is the kind of thing a Republican governor does to a Democratic White House or the other way around. DeSantis isn't losing anything here. He knows that in the end it will all kind of resolve. But you know, he's taking that stand, and you know, it's politically motivated, as we talked about. And I think ultimately that is going to be the path we see here. We're going to see some sort of settlement. I think Attorney General Ashley Moody, who's the point person for legal efforts, would admit this if he got her out of soundbite mode. I mean, she's basically said as much to me. So you know, you're going to see this kind of resolve itself in the courts, and eventually I believe it will resolve in a way that sort of splits the difference somehow, because it's kind of got to.
Dr. Mokhtad, 1 minute left or so to the break. What's your reaction as a physician and a public health expert on these kinds of moves by Florida leadership when it comes to COVID?
You know, when it comes to COVID, you cannot put a political spin on a pandemic. I mean, the governor has done this before, said we don't have a problem like New York, and Florida had a wave after a wave. So you need to be realistic and deal with COVID-19 and encourage your public to go and get the vaccine.
We'll keep talking about that. Vaccine hesitancy, rising COVID cases, and your calls as we continue the conversation here on the Florida Roundup about this disturbing uptick in COVID cases and hospitalizations. The vast majority of people coming into hospitals now are not vaccinated. Why won't people get the vaccine? We'll talk more about that in a moment. It's the Florida Roundup. Your calls and tweets after the break. 305-995-1800. Get on the line. It's the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week, and as we continue the conversation with Dr. Ali Mokhtad of the University of Washington and A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, lots of calls and tweets as we talk about spiking COVID cases in the state. It's the unvaccinated who are getting sick now, folks. 305-995-1800. Give us a call. Randy is on the line in Lake Worth, Florida. Hey, Randy, go ahead. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Hello there. How are you?
Great, thanks.
So I'm a dissenting view. I disagree. I have worked for the past 2 years. I've never taken a day off. I've been around many, many different people. I know nobody close to me who has been hospitalized because of COVID. And I don't understand all the hype. What is wrong with letting COVID take its course?
Okay, Randy, thanks for calling in. Dr. Mokhdad, you know, there are a lot of Florida residents out there, a lot of people across America who share Randy's view. They believe that concerns about the pandemic are overblown. They're reluctant to get vaccinated or they flat out refuse. Unfortunately, that is prolonging the pandemic and it is resulting in more deaths. So what's your message to Randy and people who feel the way he does?
Randy, if we let the COVID-19 pandemic, as you're suggesting, go, we will have much more mortality and we will overwhelm our hospitals. And we have been very close in many hospitals that they were at capacity and they had to send patients elsewhere. So it's an option that we cannot afford. Your point that you have been healthy and you didn't get COVID-19, that's very good. I'm so happy. But remember, Randy, that we had people who smoked their entire life and they lived for a long time. Churchill is one example. It doesn't mean that smoking doesn't kill people. We have documentations about that. So your experience is a good experience for you, but it does not reflect of what's going out there. We need all of us to get the vaccine to protect ourselves and go back to our normality. And yes, once we get the vaccine, everybody will benefit like you benefited. They will not get the COVID-19. They will not end up in a hospital and they will not die from COVID-19.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Doctor, when hospitals have to cancel elective surgeries and blow off other kinds of medical procedures because of the rise in COVID cases. Well, Randy, I don't know if you're still listening. Think about how that affects health. Like you say a loved one of yours had to go into the hospital for some reason or other, and they didn't get the best care because the hospital is so stretched dealing with the COVID patients. That's an example of how this affects us all. Lots of calls.
Melissa, in many countries, and even close here in Texas, we had a very close call where patients were not admitted, even COVID-19 patients, they were sent elsewhere. We have a lot of now reports from many countries, they don't have hospitals, they don't have beds anymore, and people are laying down in the street. We've seen the images. We need to be very careful.
Mary in St. Augustine. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Oh, I love your show. I want to get that plug in really fast.
Oh, thank you.
I wish I had like a really positive thing to say. I find myself in a tricky spot. I work for the health department as a nurse practitioner, and I'm a reservist in the Air Force. And in both settings, I have colleagues that are not vaccinated. Mm-hmm. In the Air Force, we're on the verge of ordering people to get the vaccine because our numbers are low. My reserve unit is in another state outside of Florida, but you know, if we're going to deploy people, we order them to get the smallpox vaccine because they're going to areas where that's common. So it's not unusual in the military to, at some point, with good data, say you must do this.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's going to ever happen in our country with COVID. My son is a high schooler. His high school principal died this year from COVID, and he was a healthy track coach. I'm disheartened. I thought once we had vaccine available, it would change, but we have lots available, and I find myself in settings where we open a vial and we have a couple of doses left over at the end.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mary. You know, A.G. Gankarski, you've talked quite insightfully about the governor's political calculations. That said, you know, we just heard from someone with ties to the military. The governor has military service on his resume. He served in the JAG Corps. He's also Ivy League educated. He's had access to the insights of the best public health experts around. So isn't it politically isn't it irresponsible as the leader of a state to be aligning oneself with anti-vaccine, anti-public health propaganda when people are coming into hospitals in Florida at such greater numbers right now? Okay, we seem to have lost AG. But Dr. Mokhtad, you know, I would say
the governor.
Oh, there he is. Go ahead.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd say the governor. The governor's basically, you know, making two different distinctions there. On one hand, he says, you know, he has pushed the vaccine. He has said the vaccine is available. He's gone across the state and, you know, so on. But the political operation is the political operation. And, you know, Dr. Fauci to DeSantis, to Marco Rubio, to these Republicans in general, is basically a symbol of big government, basically the current iteration of the sort of limousine liberals that Ronald Reagan and the like used to lampoon. They talk about Fauci being on a magazine cover and the period where Fauci was a sex symbol. That's one thing. But I do want to speak about the vaccines also. I mean, these were expedited conditional approvals, these vaccines. They were fast-tracked during the Donald Trump administration. And there were people a year ago saying they weren't going to take a Donald Trump vaccine either. So there's been a lot of misinformation. There's been a lot of politicization. And it's sort of a measure of this age, both the politicians that we have and the coarsening of the public itself, to where, you know, public health and public safety, you know, has become a political football. But it's easier to talk about that than things like what's happening to the currency, what's happened to the job market, and so on. So, you know, it's almost like we have found a symbolic hill to die on as a culture, and we have the vaccine to prevent it.
Yeah, that's the tragedy of it, Dr. Mokhtad. Unlike other countries where people are desperate for the vaccine, in America, it's readily available on almost every corner, yet we've become so polarized as a country that we will probably not be able to get to herd immunity.
Exactly. So we're divided, unfortunately, and even masks became a political symbol in the United States, and we need to encourage the public to get the vaccine. And one way to do it is right now, when people get admitted to a hospital for COVID-19, is to reach out to their circle, their relatives, and say, you know, one of you unfortunately got infected. Please come and get the vaccine. And we need to get our act together in the United States, in every state, and start doing so. Treat it like an outbreak, and then go to the contact of that person who has been infected and say, please come and get the vaccine. We don't want you to end in the hospital like one of you. And then we should prevent this by getting the vaccine.
Thank you both so much for joining us here on the Florida Roundup this Friday. Dr. Ali Mokhtad, Chief Strategy Officer, Population Health at the University of Washington, studying the pandemic across the country and here in Florida. And A.G. Gankarski, reporter with Florida Politics. Guys, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you for having
Thank you.
Us.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Well, two Caribbean countries are in crisis. Last week, Haitian President Jovenel Moise was assassinated in his home. The country went into a state of emergency. A few days later, thousands of Cubans took to the streets to protest their government and call for an end to the communist regime. Similar demonstrations took place throughout Florida, drawing large crowds and statements from local and federal officials. Despite the uncertainty, violence, and famine Cubans and Haitians are currently experiencing, the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, warned residents of those countries not to consider fleeing to the United States. We will have more on the current situation of both countries and what lies ahead for them, and you can join the conversation, too. Do you have family or ties to Cuba or Haiti? What are your thoughts as we follow these stories? 305-995-1800 and tweet us at Florida Roundup. To help us understand everything unfolding in Cuba and Haiti, we welcome the Americas editor of our sister station, WLRN, Tim Padgett. Hi, Tim. Good to have you on the show. Danielle Cleland, associate professor for the University of Texas in Austin, who has been teaching Caribbean studies and politics for more than a decade. Professor Cleland, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And rounding out our panel, Calvin Hughes, a news anchor for WPLG in South Florida, following developments in Haiti. Hi, Calvin.
Hi there. How are you?
Great, thanks. 305-995-1800 to join the show. Calvin, let's start with you. There have been reports of Colombian mercenaries being hired to kill the Haitian president. More than a handful of arrests have been made in connection to this assassination. Authorities claim to have killed several other suspects as well. What is known at this time about the assassination of President Moise?
Well, there are still a lot of questions about who was the mastermind. And I think that is the main question that police are trying to get to and they want to unravel. But even the head of the national police, the head of the national security at the National Palace was arrested or detained. They haven't exactly come up with the charge just yet. But right now, nearly 30 people have been arrested. And again, we don't know the charges that they're facing, even for the main person who is considered a suspect, Sanon, Christian Emmanuel Sanon. He is the Haitian doctor who appears to have tried to organize everybody and said that he was going to take over as president once Moise was arrested. And that seemed to be the original plan, which was to go to his home, kidnap him, and then go to the National Palace and then swear in Sanon. But as it appears, the plan changed at some point. And when it changed, obviously it changed to kill Jovenel Moise and his residence. But right now, police are still just trying to unravel who bankrolled this operation and also trying to figure out what was really behind the plot.
There may be a Florida connection. Some Floridians have been arrested in connection to the assassination. What do we know about their alleged involvement?
Well, right now, we know that two of them are claiming to have had connections to the plot, and they are claiming to have been translators only. But right now, again, police are still trying to figure out exactly what their role was. But we don't know, again, we just don't know the charges. National police are not answering a lot of questions in Haiti, so we just don't know what their real involvement was. But yes, two Haitian Americans have in fact been involved in it. And also there is a security firm that was operated by a Venezuelan, Antonio Intriago. And he apparently was not involved in these meetings that were taking place over time, but he apparently was involved by hiring the 20 plus Colombians who were apparently trained by the U.S. At some point, but which is quite common, by the way, for Colombian soldiers to be trained by the U.S. But these Colombians were thinking that they were going to serve as bodyguards over in Haiti. But again, at some point, the plan changed from serving as bodyguards to kidnapping the president to actually killing the president of Haiti.
Now, at the same time, the president's wife, Martine Moise, was wounded in this attack, airlifted to a hospital in Miami. What do we know about her condition right now?
Well, right now we know that she was shot in the abdomen, she was shot in the leg, and she was shot in her arm. And she tweeted out a picture a couple of days ago, basically thanking everyone who was involved in helping save her life at Jackson's Ryder Trauma Center. She thanked the doctors and the nurses and everyone who helped her. But by the grace of God, she was able to survive. My sources are telling me that apparently when the gunman burst into the room, they shot her first, and she was lying on the floor and she played dead. The mercenaries apparently stood over her, saw her bleeding from the mouth, and they thought that she was dead. And she listened to them as they apparently were talking in Spanish. I'm not sure if she understood. My source is not telling me that, but apparently she listened to them as they talked in Spanish, and then after that, they shot the president. But then they walked out thinking that she was dead. But apparently the people around the president were able to get to her and get her to emergency help, and she was able to be flown here to Jackson Memorial, to Jackson Ryder Trauma Center, and as a result, she survived. So there is no doubt that everyone is trying to talk with her so that we can figure out exactly what happened.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Let's talk Cuba now with the Americas editor of WLRN, Tim Padgett. Tim, video of the protests in Cuba spread like wildfire online over last weekend, and there were demonstrations across Florida as well. Can you explain quickly what led to this unprecedented uprising in Cuba in modern times?
It was a very full powder keg of things that suddenly erupted on Sunday, really. You had, growing, desperate economic complaints on the part of the people in Cuba. The pandemic has just really deteriorated the Cuban economy. Its main cash cow, tourism, has fallen by about 75% over the past year. And then you couple that with the Trump economic sanctions that President Trump put in effect during his presidency that have cut off a lot more money to the island. That has really made things difficult. But then you also have to factor in the Cuban government's just gross economic mismanagement and incompetence. And then on top of that, the government, the communist regime's oppression and repression of people. And finally, just on Sunday, in a small town not far from Havana, where people had been experiencing, days of electricity outages, and they were sweating and hot and just frustrated and angry, and they finally came out protesting, screaming or shouting, "No tenemos miedo, we're not afraid.
We're not afraid."
And we're not afraid, which is significant, because there's always been this feeling that Cubans were too afraid to confront the regime.
Confront the regime. Hold that thought, Tim. 305-995-1800. Call us about Cuba. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, we're talking about two Caribbean countries in crisis. Cuba experiencing a countrywide uprising against its authoritarian government, and Haiti sent into a tailspin after the assassination of its president, Jovenel Moise. 305-995-1800 and tweet us at Florida Roundup as we continue with our panel. Let's go to David in Newport Richey. David, you have comments about Cuba?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Okay, good. Like I told your screener there, my next door neighbor is a Cuban lady, and she, up until the time that they chopped internet service and phone service down there, was religiously in contact with her folks back home two or three times a week. And then they, like I say, they chopped cut the phone service and the internet service, and contact has been spotty. But right up until that time, one of the reports she got from her friends or family back home was that a neighborhood boy, 18 years old, was taken into custody. They ripped out his teeth. This gets gross. They ripped out his teeth with pliers, gouged out his eyes, and let him bleed to death.
Wow.
How's that sound?
Thank you, David. Yeah, it's pretty grisly. Sure. Yeah, there is no free speech, no rights on the island that we enjoy in this country. So, Tim Padgett, if you could pick up where you left off, the demonstrators were chanting, "We are not afraid." But clearly they have good reason to be afraid for protesting.
Oh, sure. But as I said, the frustrations have built up to such an intense degree that on Sunday, as I said, in this small town called San Antonio de los Baños, those frustrations just blew up, and people just went out into the streets and started protesting. But the most significant thing is that they started using social media, which Cubans have only really had access to for just the past few years, but they've become very savvy at it. And these people in San Antonio de los Baños started live streaming, tweeting out their protests, and it caught fire from Havana all the way over to the eastern coast in Santiago, all across the island. And that's what made these protests so unprecedented in Cuba, was the fact that it was island-wide and more angry than we've ever seen. Images of people overturning police cars in Havana. I never thought I would see that as a correspondent covering Cuba. So it is unprecedented.
Let's bring in Danielle Cleland now, associate professor for the University of Texas in Austin. She's been teaching Caribbean studies and politics for more than a decade. Professor, good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're getting calls about U.S. policy toward Cuba. Some folks feel the embargo should be lifted, that that's driving unrest in Cuba. The Black Lives Matter movement posted a statement calling for a lifting of the embargo. They blamed America for much of the suffering in Cuba. You've tweeted that statement lacked some context. There are a lot of threads to this. So can you explain what you meant by that?
Yes, I think that, you know, what Tim said was right, that the embargo is damaging to the economy, but it is a piece of the puzzle. And so what we're looking at is economic crisis based on a number of factors. And certainly the embargo exacerbates that. What I tweeted about the Black Lives Matter statement was that these protests were not necessarily directly against the US embargo, and that we also have to take into context the way in which the Cuban government has been with its own citizens. And so I think Black Lives Matter was coming from a frame where the Cuban revolution has been instrumental in supporting Black liberation across the globe. But we have to also remember that they have not been supportive of Black affirmation and Black activism domestically. And so, you know, when we talk about, you know, anti-Blackness, we have to talk about what happens in Cuba. And so we can't blindly just kind of support the Cuban revolution because of what they've done abroad without really talking about what they've done on the island.
It was also striking to note that Cuban Americans protesting in Florida this week, some of them did block traffic. They won praise from the governor, Senator Marco Rubio, even though political leadership in Florida has pushed a new anti-protest law onto the books that essentially criminalizes that kind of protest. That has sparked more legal action about that law from other groups like Black Lives Matter affiliated groups. They see it as selective enforcement of the law. Let's go quickly to Elizabeth in Durham. Durham, you're a Cuban American, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi, yes, I'm Cuban American, and I was calling in mostly to say that to me as a Cuban American and to a lot of other folks that are in the same shoes, feel that there's a lot of noise going on and people are really missing the mark and focusing on the issue, which is really that the Cuban people are not screaming out that they need food and that they are being hurt by COVID. It's that they want libertad, they want freedom, meaning they want freedom from a regime that is authoritarian dictatorship. And as someone that speaks to my family there and follows the news very closely and have been to Cuba personally, I can speak from the Cuban people that we are frustrated by the noise of BML and the noise of, hey, let's open the embargo because that's going to be the cure. It's not. People want it to be dismantled from the inside out. They want a democratic government. They've been wanting that for a very long time.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Tim Padgett, America's editor at WLRN. Your thoughts about the calls for liberty in Cuba and a democratically elected government?
Well, I think the Cuban people have always wanted libertad, but I would disagree with Elizabeth to a certain degree, because I don't think you can discount how the pandemic and the food and medicine and electricity shortages on the island really lit the powder keg that I was talking about before here. Now, again, whether that's because of the embargo or because of the Cuban regime's, as I said before, economic incompetence and repression, or both. What the reality is that these economic factors did play a large role in building up that frustration to the point where Americans or Cubans, as we said before, simply did not feel any more fear in terms of, about going out into the streets and asking for libertad. So it's all part, as you said before, part of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As Ms. Cleland said before.
Yes, yeah. Part of the puzzle here. And we talk about it here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. So, Professor Cleland, there have been calls from Cuban Americans to intervene for the president to provide internet access to Cuba. What's your reaction to those calls from the Cuban American diaspora, particularly here in Florida?
Well, I think it's part of a historical pattern of this kind of thought, mostly on the right, I would say, of wanting the U.S. to intervene militarily in Cuba. Certainly, I am against that. And I think that most folks in Cuba would be against that as well. You know, the real point here is that Cubans want to solve their own problems themselves. And so I think that when we're thinking about internet access, that's a perhaps a different story. But overall, U.S. intervention should be focused on lifting the embargo. President Biden should be looking at cutting a lot of the Trump-era U.S. sanctions that were applied so that folks can send remittances to their family more freely. And so we really should be looking at U.S. policy toward Cuba rather than these kinds of talks about military intervention, which really challenge Cuba's sovereignty. You know, we don't support anti-democratic governments, but at the same time, we don't support imperialist intervention either.
Let's, before we wrap it up, go back to Haiti. Calvin Hughes, WPLG, what lies ahead for Haiti? What leads are you looking into over the coming weeks following on the assassination?
Well, if I can say a couple of things. One is going back to your discussion about Cuba. I was there for the Pope's visit, Benedict XVI, Pope Francis. I was there for Obama opening up the embassy. I was also there when Raul Castro stepped down as president and Miguel Diaz-Canel was inaugurated or appointed to be in that position. And that I agree with your panelists. And that, you know, Cuba simply wants to decide its own fate. It doesn't need to have some outside entity decide that. But as for Haiti, Haiti is pretty much the same way. Haiti would like to decide its own fate. And I think President Biden is put into sort of a pickle here because he's withdrawing troops out of Afghanistan. Yet at the same time, he is trying to decide whether or not to send U.S. troops back into Haiti. And there are people who have sort of mixed reactions to that because we know the U.S. occupation in Haiti is checkered at best, considering what happened back in 1915 and led to so many issues in Haiti that still exist today, especially with its economy. So Haiti's future is really unknown at this point, especially politically, because you have sort of a perfect storm here. It's dealing with a COVID crisis, even though it got a 500,000 Moderna vaccines from the government, the U.S. government this week. It's also dealing with the humanitarian crisis. There are over 4 million people who are suffering from hunger and deep poverty, the terrible grips of poverty and hunger. You also have a political storm as it relates to having two prime ministers at this point, Ariel Henry, who is supposed to be the prime minister and may be inaugurated this weekend, may take the reins this weekend, but you also have Claude Joseph, who is the acting prime minister. And you also have Joseph Lambert, who is the Senate president and was and has the approval of 9 of his Senate colleagues that to take over as the interim president. So you have a number of issues.
Which you have done an excellent job of explaining to this statewide audience. So thank you, Calvin Hughes, WPLG, Danielle Cleland, University of Texas, Austin, and Tim Padgett, America's editor at WLRN. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Padormo are show producers. Director of Radio Operations, Technical Director is Peter Meritz, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for calling, tweeting, and listening. We'll be back next Friday at noon. Have a great weekend.